Good morning, everybody. Lovely to see you. Thank you for coming. Very exciting to see that people are coming back. We have, I think, about 25 people here. I don't want to scare anybody off coming. There's plenty of room. There's enough room for at least another 25 people with space as well. So I encourage you to come if you can and join the share live. But certainly if you're with us on Zoom, then that is also wonderful. Thank you for that too. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let me start with a thanks to our sponsor, that the Shirim for the whole academic year of 2021 have been sponsored very kindly and anonymously in the merit of an aliyah for the neshamas of Matasyahu ben Yisrael, Aaron ben Menachem Leib, and Eliana bat Yaakov. Thank you for the sponsorship, much appreciated. It should be an aliyah for their neshamas. Now, let's look forward a little bit. We are today on part three of a three-part series, dealing with Yom HaTzma'ut and Geula and things like that. We'll talk about that in a second. Just going forward, looking forward, what I'd like to do, please God, for the next few weeks is as follows. We've had some quite heavy Hashkafah-focused Shi'urim over the last few weeks, and I'm feeling a little bit of a need for some more halachic stuff coming up. So I'd like to stay on the Israel theme, but deal with a number of discrete topics over the next 3 or 4 weeks, dealing with halachic issues which specifically apply in Israel. Not Trumas and Maestros specifically, but issues and things that come up in Israel. There are many, many such like. We'll talk about them over the next few weeks, just for 2 or 3 weeks to get us back in a halachic framework. Then I want to try and tackle something on Geirus. We've never talked about conversion, and it's a big, big issue. Not just halachic, hashkafic, in Israel, outside Israel. I'd like to do a little bit of a series on Geirus, again, which we've never looked at. And then after that, I think we're just about ready for the Shemitah series. And we can dust off our shirim from 7 years ago and get some Shemitah stuff in. I'm still waiting for Brikas HaChama to come back to dust off my Brikas HaChama shir, but that's another 15 years. So okay, so we'll stay tuned for that. But Shemitah, thank God, comes around every 7 years, and there's a lot to talk about. So that should take us through the summer. I'm sure that some people will be away a little bit. I might be away myself a little bit, but we'll see how that goes. Fine. For now, we are in a fascinating discussion, I find it fascinating, about what's going on around us. What is the process that we're seeing? And 2 weeks ago, we looked a little bit at the issue of kibbutz galuyot, and how to interpret that and how to understand that. We looked at the Satmar Rebbe and the Vayol Moshe. We looked at the three oaths. We looked at responses, Rav Aliner, etc. Last week, we looked in more depth at the issue of Geula. What is Geula and how do we understand it? And what is Tshuva? And is Tshuva return to Hashem or return to the land or both? And what are the different perspectives on that? This week, I feel that we cannot leave this topic without talking about the third option. We've been looking at things in a very binary way. Either you're a kuknik, in which case everything is geula and you're working towards redemption and maybe Mashiach, we talked about the difference between them, or you're more Haredi or even anti-Zionist. I think the Haredi world is usually just non-Zionist specifically, although it's moving more towards a Zionist place, we see that clearly. But we talked about the Satmar Rebbe. There aren't just two options. There is what Rav Soloveitchik himself called the third way, or a third way, which is the Torah of Rav Soloveitchik and his Talmidim on the issue of Medinat Yisrael. This is a big topic, and I was a little bit nervous to take it on, because there's a lot to say, and how to organize it is not so straightforward. So I hope what we're doing today will work. Almost everything we're going to see today is in English, which makes sense, because it's material from Rav Soloveitchik, which was not written in Hebrew, which was originally given often in Yiddish. So my Yiddish is not good enough for us to go through the drasha in Yiddish, but my English hopefully will be fine. I am a little hesitant to talk about Rav Soloveitchik's Torah, because I cannot pretend to be a direct Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik. I know there are people in this room, I know Jerry, I know others, who were connected really personally with Rav Soloveitchik. Which is one of the reasons why I haven't referred to Rav Soloveitchik in the sheet as the Rav, because I felt that was a bit presumptuous on my part to say that, like, it's the Rav, because I don't have a Masorah directly from him, but I have nevertheless delved into many of the things he said, and we'll talk about them today, and we'll see if we can present a perspective on religious Zionism which is not the one that we usually hear in Israel. And the question is the pendulum swinging? And if so, in which way? Has religious Zionism morphed a little bit over the last 20 years after the Oslo Accords, after Gush Katif? Has it moved a little bit away from the Rav Kook vision and more Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook vision towards the Rav Soloveitchik vision or not? And I'll leave you to think about that as we're going through the shiur. Fine. Let's look a little bit historical background. The sheet is quite long. We're not going to look at every single source, but we will be able to look at quite a few things. Many people, of course, are very familiar with the teaching of Rav Soloveitchik and his background. He was born in Poland in 1903 into a very famous family. His grandfather, Rav Chaim, known as Rav Chaim Brisker, was obviously the Rosh Hashiva, co-Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin, before he moved away to Brisk. Part of, by the way, the roots of this different perspective on Zionism is part of it is rooted in the division between the Netziv and Rav Chaim in Volozhin itself. The Netziv himself was one of the early supporters of Chobavei Tzion, although he himself moved on that issue a little bit, whereas Rav Chaim Brisker was very clearly not. The original Briskers, and still that side of the Brisk family in Israel, in the Soloveitchik family, are not at all Zionist. In fact, they're pretty anti-Zionist. Rav Soloveitchik grew up in that home, with all that went with it in terms of Torah learning, but he broke in many ways from the Soloveitchik background when he moved to Berlin in the 1920s to pursue secular studies at a very deep level, and he got a PhD in 1931. Now, interesting, later he's going to talk about the angst that he felt moving from a non- or even anti-Zionist family to a very pro-Zionist Mizrahi perspective, and how he grappled with that. He doesn't anyway talk about the angst, any angst he felt in moving towards a PhD, which is very interesting, because that was also a major shift. But that he did, and seems to have been very smooth. The Zionism was not so smooth. Anyway, in 1932 he moved to Boston. He became a representative in Boston of the Agudas Yisrael. That was the Soloveitchik background, and that of course was a non-Zionist or even an anti-Zionist agenda. In 1935 he made his one trip to Eretz Yisrael in his life, and we'll talk a little bit later as to why maybe he didn't make Aliyah and why he didn't visit Israel more. He applied to be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and he did not succeed in that application, probably because he was too associated with Agudas Yisrael. There was a lot of discussion, was he too young? Don't forget, his uncle, Rav Meir Bar-Ilan, was very established as one of the leaders of Zionism, but Rav Soloveitchik, as a young man, was still associated very much with the classic Soloveitchik Aguda approach. He did get to meet with Rav Kook, Rav Avram Yitzchak Kook, a few weeks before Rav Kook died, which was a very special meeting, and there are all sorts of accounts of how that worked. If you're interested, later I'm going to mention it, but I'll mention it now, that in 2006, Tradition Journal brought out an entire issue dedicated to Kol Dodi Dofek, which we'll talk about in length, 50 years on. And in that edition of Tradition, which I really recommend you look at, are 15 or 16 articles, one of which talks about Rav Kook's meeting with Rav Soloveitchik and how that worked. Lots to say about that, but not for now. Came back to America, and over the next 20 years, his views on Zionism really radically changed. Slowly at first, but then accelerated by the experience of the Holocaust and the Second World War, when, of course, he was in America. And by 1944, he was the chairman of the Central Committee of Mizrahi Religious Zionists in America. His father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, was also connected with Mizrahi back in Poland when he was a Rav in a Mizrahi school, but that was not a happy situation. And people talk about the fact that there was a lot of tension. He was rejected by his family to some degree by having connected with Mizrahi, and yet he was also alienated by the Mizrahi establishment in the school for being too Haredi. You can probably understand how that would work. And Rav Soloveitchik himself, of course, had that behind him, but he clearly moved over to Mizrahi. By 1941, of course, he was the Rosh Hashiva of the Rav Yitzchak Elkanan Theological Seminary in YU, where he also remained a professor of philosophy for life. Look at number one for a second. The Rav's four drushes, which were four drushes, which became fünf drushes, five addresses, but more about that soon, he talks about his relationship with Mizrahi. So just a few lines to start with. Number one, I was not born into a Zionist household, writes Rav Soloveitchik. My parents' ancestors, my father's house, my teachers, my colleagues were far from the Mizrahi religious Zionists. My link with the Mizrahi grew gradually. I had my doubts about the validity of the Mizrahi approach. If I now identify with Mizrahi against my family tradition, it is only because I feel like divine providence ruled like Yosef and against his brothers. This is a very important, just in parentheses, metaphor that he uses in comparison in the first of the five addresses. I recommend that you read it in full. he talked brilliantly about Yosef and the brothers, and when Yosef had a dream, they of course were shepherds, when Yosef had a dream of them collecting wheat and making sheaves of wheat, says Rav Soloveitchik, that represents Yosef saying to the brothers, we won't be able to do what we do now for much longer. We are going to have to change. There's going to have to be a shift in paradigm from what we've always done to what we'll have to get used to doing. And the brothers rejected this, and Rav Soloveitchik treats this as an argument parallel with the Mizrahi and the Aguda world. The Aguda world insists that the 20th century will be the same as the 19th, and the 17th, and the 15th, we'll do what we always did. And Rav Soloveitchik says, no, the Mizrahi is like Yosef, who comes along and says, you may not like to hear this, but we cannot do what we always did. There has to be a new paradigm. So he says that he felt that God paskens like Yosef in this. Just like he did in the, you know, they ended up in Egypt and they ended up in a new situation. And therefore he writes, I built an altar upon which I sacrificed sleepless nights, doubts and reservations. Regardless, the years of the Hitlerian Holocaust, the establishment of the State of Israel, and the accomplishment of the Mizrahi in the land of Israel convinced me of the correctness of our movement's path. The altar still stands today, he wrote in the 60s, with smoke rising from the sacrifice upon it. Jews like me are required to sacrifice on this altar their peace of mind as well as their social relationships and friendships. That's quite a meaningful passage where Rav Soloveitchik, even 25 years later, after his shift to Mizrahi, feels that it costs him. It's not something which he did in any way simply or without a lot of thought. And of course, over the next 50 years, Rav Soloveitchik developed a position on religious Zionism, which we'll talk about now, and through the Shir, which sometimes people call the third way. Let's have a look on the top of page 2, and we'll see in source number 2 what I mean by that. Here, in the Rav's letters, which were published as Community Covenant Commitment, he writes as follows. I agree with you that there is a third halachic approach, which is neither parallel to the position of those, quote, who eyes are shut and reject the significance of the state, nor the belief of those dreamers who adopt a completely positive stance to the point where they identify the State of Israel with the fulfillment of the highest goal of our historical meta-historic historical destiny. This third approach, which is the shir that I'm trying to present to you today, this third approach, which is the normative one in all areas, I would allow myself to guess will be positively inclined towards the state and would express gratitude for its establishment out of a sense of love and devotion, but would not attach to it excessive value to the point of its glorification and deification. And later on we're going to see explicitly where the Rav warns in 1948 about the idolatry that could come with the State of Israel, making the state itself into an Avodah Zarah. And he's talking to Mizrahi about that, and we'll see what he talks about soon. Now, obviously the Rav's seminal work, Rav Soloveitchik's seminal work on Zionism is Kol Dodi Dovek. This he gave as an address in 1956 to the convention of the Religious Zionists of America on the 8th anniversary of the State of Israel. Yom HaTzmaut 1956, he delivered this address. Later it was published, it was translated into Hebrew, into English. And actually in Israel, Kol Dodi Dovek became, I don't know if it still is, I don't think that my son studied Kol Dodi Dovek at school, but there again he went to Merkez Harav, he went to Yashlat, and I'm not sure that would have been their core curriculum. But Kol Dodi Dovek used to be a classic learned by Israeli kids, and the very last source on the sheet, some of the Israeli kids in Givat Washington in the 1960s asked their teacher to write to Rav Soloveitchik and ask him, if he's such a big religious Zionist, why did he not make Aliyah? And she, a bit of a chutzpahdik question, but she did. She wrote to him, and at the end of the shiur we'll see his response, which is very interesting. So what is Kol Dodi Dovek? Kol Dodi Dovek is based, of course, on Shir HaShirim. Let's look at number 3. The central narrative of Shir HaShirim is in chapter 5, where, of course, the beloved, the Doda, is looking for the lover, the Dod, and they're searching for each other, and they're missing each other, and of course this is the parallel parable for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who is the lover looking for Knesset Yisrael, Klal Yisrael, who is the beloved. And at one point they almost connect in the middle of Shir HaShirim. Look at number 3. Let's look at this in Hebrew. We have to have some Hebrew in the Shir. Ani Yishena, I am going to sleep. V'libi er, but my heart remains awake. Kol. Now, how you translate Kol Dodi Dofek, there are two ways to translate it. Either you say Kol Dodi Dofek, the voice of my beloved is knocking, or kol, listen, dodidofek, which sounds more accurate based on the way it's punctuated here. Kol, listen, dodidofek, there's a knocking at the door. Titchili achoti. He's saying, beloved, my sister, open the door for me, rayati, yonati, tamati. Shiroshim nimlatal, my hair is full of dew. These are all different references to different metaphors. Kvutatayra tisei laila. And she is able now to open the door. There's a knocking at the door, and it's the beloved there. And she says, pashatati et kutanti. I've already taken off my clothes. I'm in my pajamas already. Echachal bishena. Do I really have to get dressed? Rachati et ragli. I've already had a shower. You know, I'm ready for bed. I've washed my feet. Echachat hanfein. Do I really have to get my shoes on and get them dirty again? And of course, she doesn't go. So the beloved is even, the lover is even putting his hand through the lock, saying, hi, just open the door. Umai hamuala. Kamti. And then eventually she says, I must be crazy. I get up. Kamti. I nearly poach le dodi. I came to open the door. V'yadai natfu mor. There's more time, more over. Well, mud dripping from my hands and my fingers. Akapot amalu. I'm on the actual lock itself. Patachti. And I open the door. Ani le dodi. V'dodi chamakvav. And he's gone. Why is he gone? Because he only knocks for so long. The dod only knocks for so long, and if you don't answer the door, or if you answer too late, then he won't be there. Now, Rav Soloveitchik was not the first person to use this as a metaphor for coming to the land of Israel. Already, the Kuzari, and let's have a look at the Kuzari, which is the foundation for Rav Soloveitchik and Kol Dodi Dofek, talks about this in the 12th century. Have a look at number 4. This is the exchange between the king of the Khazars. You know how the Kuzari works. The Kuzari is a synthesized conversation between a rabbi. I mean, at the beginning there's also a priest and an imam or whatever, and a philosopher. But basically between a rabbi and the king of the Khazars. At some point historically, the Khazari people converted to Judaism. By the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, in the 11th, 12th century, this was already historic, but he says, let's use this encounter between the king, if you like, and the rabbi, and see, write a sefer on Hashkafa and Machshava based on that conversation. This was not a record, obviously, of the conversation, if such a conversation ever happened, but it's a way of presenting the Machshava in an interesting and an engaging way. So he says as follows, number 4. The rabbi says, it is better to dwell in the Holy Land, even in a town mostly inhabited by heathens, than abroad in a town chiefly peopled by Israelites. We saw that source in Sanhedrin. For he who dwells in the Holy Land is compared to someone who has a god, while he who dwells abroad is compared to him who has no god. The rabbi is talking about Eretz Israel. Further, the atmosphere of the Holy Land makes you wise. They express their love of the land as follows. He who walks Dalet Amos in the land is assured of happiness in the world to come. The rabbi is waxing lyrical about how amazing Eretz Israel is. Says the king, if this is so, you fall short of the duty laid down by your law by not endeavoring to reach the place and making it your abode in life and death. All nations agree on the point. He talks about the Crusades, etc. Further, everybody turns to it in prayer, visits it in pilgrimage. Your bowing and kneeling in the direction of it is either mere appearance or thoughtless worship, meaning you're hypocrites. You're big Zionists and you don't go to Israel. You're like a vegetarian that eats meat. What's going on? Number 24 says the rabbi, oi, this is a severe reproach, O king of the Khazars. It is the sin which kept the divine promise with regard to the second temple from being fulfilled. Divine providence was ready to restore everything as it had been at first. This is based on a Gemara. It actually was a Daf Yomi, today, yesterday. If they had all been willing to consent to return, but only a part was ready to do so, whilst the majority in the aristocracy remained in Bava, preparing dependence and slavery and unwilling to leave their houses and their affairs in in Bava. It is the slip of the tongue. It is the voice of my beloved that knocks, and he brings here Kol Dodi Dofek. It means God's calling to return. The words I've taken off my coat refers to the people's laziness, slothfulness in consenting to return. Were we prepared to meet the God of our forefathers with a pure mind, we should find the same salvation as our fathers did in Egypt. We could have a Geula Shleima. We just don't bother. If we say, worship on his holy hill, worship at his footstool, he who restores the glory to Zion, in other words, this is but the chattering of the starling and the nightingale. We do not realize what we say by this sentence, nor others, as you rightly observe, Prince of the Khazars. And therefore, the Rav Yehuda HaLevi is saying, we are hypocritical. He himself made Aliyah eventually by the end of his life, and there are different legends, whether he was, mowed down by a horseman as he got here, whatever, that's beside the point. But Rav Soloveitchik obviously builds on this Kuzari, and he says, let's explore this now. If the Kuzari felt that God was knocking at the door in the 12th century, the 11th century, then in 1956, surely God is knocking at the door. And Rav Soloveitchik in 1956 is saying to the American Jewish people that God's been knocking for 8 years. I don't know how long he's going to continue to knock. Let's have a look at some of these issues here. So I brought you a brief, on page 3, a brief summary of how Kol Dodi Dofik works. One of the main focuses of the book, of the address rather, which became a book, is actually the meaning of evil. The Rav is dealing with the Holocaust and how we respond a few years later to the enormity of the Holocaust and why is there evil in the world. I'm not getting into that today. That's an important topic, but you should know Kol Dodi Dofik really deals with that in some depth. And then he gets to the issue of the 6 knocks, which we'll talk about soon, and he says each of these knocks has been given to us over the last 6-8 years. Then he talks about 2 covenants. This is a very important central part of the book, the Brit Goral, where he says the Jewish people are worked upon as objects. They have a common Brit that they suffer together. They share history together. They share responsibility together, but they are acted upon as objects. But their role in life is to convert what the Rav calls, what Rav Soloveitchik calls the Brit Goral to the Brit Yehud, where they can become actors, not just people who are acted upon. That they become the subjects and they convert their fate to an actual destiny and move the story forward themselves. He talks a lot about that. And then finally he talks about religious Zionism in the 1950s and what it's done and what it hasn't done and where it's succeeding and where it's failing. Because he was addressing the Mizrahi movement in America. I want to bring you a few quotes from Kol Dodi Dofik. As I said, it was originally given in Yiddish, but we'll read it in English. The Kuzari, by the way, was also written in Arabic. So we could have a potpourri of Yiddish, Arabic and everything, but then we won't get anywhere with that, or at least I won't. But have a look at a few things. Look in number 5. Says Rav Soloveitchik as follows. This is in chapter 3 of Kol Dodi Dofik. Miraculous grace places upon man an absolute responsibility to fulfill the larger imperative that calls out from the miracle. A transcendental imperative always accompanies miraculous activity. That's the first important point. If we feel that we have been the grateful recipients of innate, then that requires of us a response. That's a little bit, again, like the Brit Goral. We've been the recipients. We have to now convert that to a Brit Yehud. What do we have to do? Woe until the beneficiary of a miracle who does not recognize it for what it is and whose ear is deaf to the echo of the imperative that arises out of this meta-historical event. Pity the one who benefits from the miracles of the master of the universe, but the spark of faith is not kindled in him and his conscience is not stirred by the sight of this singular event. So he's looking at the non-Zionist world and saying, you know, what can I say to you folks? Meaning other than that I have pity on you, that you're deaf and blind to the reality that's going around you. When a miracle does not find its appropriate echo in actual deeds, a lofty vision dissipates and is squandered, whereupon divine justice indicts the ungrateful recipient of the miracle. We will be liable, he says. Judaism has been very careful about not missing the appointed hour. It has a very sensitive time awareness. Any delay is considered sinful. Man may sometimes lose his entire world, but for one sin, that of tarrying. What is the essence of the story of the Song of Songs if not the description of the paradoxical and tragic hesitation on the part of the love-intoxicated, anxiety-stricken lover when the opportunity couched in majestic awe presented itself? What is it if not the deferral of a great and sublime opportunity pregnant with a possibility of which she dreamed, for which she fought, for which she sought, and which she has searched with all the fervor of her soul? Now, I'm not going to read all of the Rav's, I brought you in source number 6, a summary of Rabbi Soloveitchik's wording on the 6 knocks, but let me just summarize them outside the sheet. Rav Soloveitchik talks here about there being at least 6 major things that he feels God has knocked us all on the head in the sense of the Kol Dodi Dofik. First of all, in the political arena. He said, when has it ever been heard of that the United States and Russia in the Cold War agree on anything? And yet they agreed on recognizing the state of Israel. He says the United Nations, he says in 1956, has probably not done anything else in its history which is useful other than recognize the state of Israel. It's interesting whether we look now 60 years later and we can think of anything else the United Nations has done, which at least from our perspective is as important as recognizing the state of Israel. So that's a political revolution, a whirlwind that occurred with God knocking. He said you can't ignore that. Secondly, on the battlefield, he says that the fact that the Israeli army in 1948, and this is of course before 67, this is 7 years, 8 years before the Six-Day War. More, 9 years before the Six-Day War. No, sorry, 11. 11 years, 1956, before the Six-Day War. See, my maths is a bit rusty. Too much sitting in the house of Corona. Okay? So the battlefield in 1948, that the Israeli army could win that war, or at least survive that war, that is clearly a miracle, which is God knocking at the door. Number two. And the fact that the Arabs hardened their hearts, if they'd only accepted the partition plan, then he said we wouldn't have had Yerushalayim, which of course we hardly had at all in 48, but still, we wouldn't have had the Galil, we wouldn't have had the Negev, and we forget this. We think about 67 and 48, and we think about the Yehuda, the Shomron, but back then they were saying, my goodness, we might have not had the Galil and the Negev, and pop, it's an amazing thing. Thirdly, he says theology, the fact that the Catholic Church is now forced to look at the state of Israel as a slap in the face, for thousands of years of Christian theology that said that God rejected the Jews, he gets a lot of hanor from that. Yeah, he gets a lot of cheshik from seeing that. He says this is probably the strongest knock of all. The fourth knock, he says, is in the youth. Think what effect, and this is in 56, Israel is going to have on young people. Now he was saying, in 56, that you can't run away anymore and pretend that you're not Jewish, because Israel's in the news all the time. And no matter how much you try to hide as a Jew in America, somebody's going to come knocking on your door saying, well, what's all this Israel stuff? This is your people doing this. So it's very interesting to talk about Yonah, who goes to the bottom of the ship and says, leave me alone. And he says, no, sorry, the captain's going to come knocking on the door saying, who are you and what have you got to do with it? But of course, we look at this now and think of all the positive association that Israel's had for young people in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s. How many young people we know connected with Judaism through the pride in Israel, is that still the case? Okay, that's a debate for later. Fifthly, he says, it's very important to understand that Jewish blood is not cheap anymore. That's a massive idea. And he says, an eye for an eye. It's an amazing, you can read it later. He says, an eye for an eye, what does that mean? It means that in court proceedings that we don't take that literally. But the Jewish blood is cheap, and people can poke out our eyes and expect no response, says that those days are over. If people are going to fight us, we will find them back and we'll win. Which is very strong words. And finally, the sixth knock, he says, is the idea that Jews now have a refuge, somewhere they can go, which has been the dream of thousands of years, that they will not just be thrown out from one non-Jewish country to the next. These are the six knocks. I strongly advise you to read it. It's all online. You can get it free. You don't have to buy the book. It's on Safaria. You can download and read it in Hebrew or English. And then he says in source number 7, so what was our reaction to the beckoning of the voice of the Beloved, to the munificence of his loving kindness and miracles? Did we get out of our beds and immediately open the door? Or did we continue to rest like the lover and were too lazy to get out of our beds? All the trembling and fear for the geographical integrity of the state of Israel, all the suggestions of our enemies, which are directed at territorial concessions by the state of Israel, all of the brazen demands of the Arabs for boundary changes are based upon one fact only. The Jews have not populated the Negev, established hundreds of settlements there. Had the Negev been settled with hundreds of thousands of Jews, even Nasser would never have dreamt of the possibility of rending it from the state of Israel. Interesting. Mass Aliyah. Why were we not there? Why have we not gone in our thousands and hundreds of thousands through the 1950s? And of course, this is true 60 years later, even more so. If half a million Jews, if a million Jews had gone to live in Yehuda v'Shomron, we are very different debate nowadays. Very, very different debate. It wouldn't be the same at all. And then he says, and let's not blame other people, we're the most blameworthy of all. He talks about the American Orthodox world being absolutely to blame for this and having not heard the knocking, and then he talks about the Kuzari, etc. These are very strong words. You should read them, very inspirational. And clearly Rav Soloveitchik has a passionately religious Zionist position. But we'll see right now that it's very different to the passion of the position of Rav Kook. So let's get into that now, and I've even made you a table which you may find helpful, but let's turn to page 5 to start with. Let me bring you a piece of Rav Soloveitchik from The Emergence of Ethical Man, which actually goes to the roots of much more of an important Machshava idea. The Emergence of Ethical Man was published after Rav Soloveitchik's death based on notes that he had for the book, which were put together by his Talmidim and then published about 15 years ago. And he talks about Kedusha, and I think this is worth focusing on for a few minutes. Look at number 8. Says Rav Soloveitchik, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Ramban, Nachmanides, the attribute of Kedusha, holiness, ascribed to the land of Israel, is an objective metaphysical quality inherent in the land. With all my respect for the Rishonim, I must disagree with such an opinion. I do not believe that it is halachically cogent. Kedusha, under a halachic aspect, is man-made. More accurately, it is a historical category. A soil is sanctified by historical deeds performed by a sacred people, never by any primordial superiority. The halachic term kedushat ha'aretz, the sanctity of the land, denotes the consequence of a human act, either conquest, his heroic deeds, or mere presence of the people in that land, intimacy of man and nature. And here he's talking about kibush or yishuv, the different factors that gave kedusha saharit in the time of Yoshua and then later in the time of Ezra. Kedusha, says Rav Soloveitchik, is identical with man's association with Mother Earth. Nothing should be attributed an a priori to dead matter. Objective kedusha smacks of fetishism. Interesting. What's he saying here? We have to understand it. What is Kedusha? What is Tahara? What do we mean when we say these things? These are the parashas, right? Tazria, Matzora, Achremos, Kedoshim. When we talk about Kedusha, what do we mean? Meaning, if I had a Geiger counter, but it was a Kedusha counter, and I could wave it over a piece of, clod of earth from Eretz Yisrael, would it register some kind of a major Kedusha, where if I wave it over a bit of soil in Hendon Park, it'll just stay flat on zero? Is that the truth? Does a Kohen have an inherent higher Kedusha than a Yisrael? A Jew than a non-Jew? What's the difference between someone who's Tahor and someone who's Tameh? And even in the Gemara, this has been a major debate. I'll give you an interesting example. I put in the footnotes here, by far the best work that I'm aware to get an overview of this in some detail is by Professor Menachem Kellner, who we have some of his illustrious relatives here as well, who wrote a book called Maimonides' Confrontation with Mysticism, where he goes through all of these issues. For example, what is Tumas Meit? So there's a very famous Gemara where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is approached by a non-Jew and asked, what's all this with the para adumah, with the ashes and sprinkling in the water? It sounds like mumbo jumbo. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in the Gemara there says to him, listen, do you ever have people who are possessed with demons or evil things? Oh yes, of course, he says. So what do you do? Well, we do this and we do this. He says, okay, so we do this and we sprinkle this and it's all fine. So then the non-Jew likes that and he leaves. And the Talmidim turn to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and say, oh, come on. That's good enough for, Chris that lives down the road. He's a happy guy. But come on, is that right? And he says to them, you know something? The mace is not really Tameh. And the water is not really Mataher in objective sense. It's a gezeirah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kedusha is up here. It's the way we relate to the land, the way we relate to the mace, the way we relate to the water. That's what creates Kedusha. It's not inherent. And yet there are other sources from Chazal that say exactly the opposite. That I think it was Rabbi Nachuni ben Akana was in a meditative state, communing with Hashem, and they thought they'd do an experiment, and they took a cloth which had been touched by the little finger of someone who is the lowest level of tumah you could have, and they touched it to his leg, and oh, he went offline all of a sudden. Because the inherent tumah caused the... What is it? So Rav Soloveitchik goes with the Maimonidean approach, which is Kedusha is created by man. It's how we relate. Eretz Yisrael is Kaddish. Why? Because we can do mitzvahs there. We can learn Torah there differently than other places. Contrast that with Rav Kook. Rav Kook's very famous opening with Avorot in number 9. We're not going to read the whole thing, but look at the contrast. He's almost talking about Rav Soloveitchik when he says what not to believe. Eretz Yisrael einenu davar chitzoni. The land of Israel is not an external thing. Kinyan chitzoni lomar, just the acquisition by the people, which is external. Rak b'tor emtzai, as a means to an end. Lemakarashel hit agdud, to unify the Jewish people, aklalit, v'hachzakat kiyumah, chomri, or to strengthen our material, ability, or afilu ruchani, or even our spiritual ability. No. Eretz Yisrael hi chativa atzmutit kushura b'keshechayim im ha'umah. It's a chativa atzmutit. Eretz Yisrael is an intrinsic, independent unit which is linked spiritually, metaphysically, with a spiritual link to the nation. Chavuka, it is enveloped with skulot pnimiyot. That's exactly what Rav Soloveitchik says it's not. Skulot pnimiyot, inner properties, hidden inner mystical properties, im mitziyutai, which are its very existence. Umitoch kach, i'er shalam odal sochen shal skulot kudoshet Eretz Yisrael, v'hoitzi pal al omek hechibata. You can't express the love or the reality, the essence of Israel, v'shum haskala rationalis, enoshit. You can't just express it in intellectual terms. It has to be, it's a spiritual love affair. Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, Torah Yisrael, it's all segulot connected to each other, and I brought you the whole piece there at the beginning and an English translation. So you see, this is just the tip of an iceberg. This machlokas between Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Kook about the nature of religious Zionism, which, by the way, is rooted in much earlier debates between Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer and Rav Yaakov Reines, the very first generation of religious Zionists in the 1870s, 80s, where Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer takes a much more mystical approach, and Rav Reines takes a much more pragmatic approach, both passionate, but different focuses. And you can see here some of the machshava roots where Rav Soloveitchik is coming from, a Maimonidean place, and Rav Kook clearly is coming from the Kuzari and the Ramban, etc. Very different place. And certainly, as I said, my son who grew up in the religious Zionist school system here, he was brought up on Kuzari and Ramban. It's all that. Not so much Morin Avuchim. Not so much Rav Soloveitchik. In fact, none at all. Okay, so that's, as I said, the tip of the iceberg. What I've done for you on pages 5, 6, and 7... even an 8, I'm going to bring a couple of things from here, is I've tried to put together a table comparing and contrasting. I will be very happy to receive your critical comments, hopefully constructively critical comments, from anybody listening on Zoom as well, as to whether you feel I've got any of this wrong or could have expressed it better. I will be very happy to upgrade it. But what I've done is, and obviously on many issues, Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Kook agree, clearly. But on many issues they do not. And I'd like to flag a few of them here, and you'll see how they all stem from this fundamental difference in approach. Go over to page 6 for a second. Let me pull out a few of these, and we'll see if we can fit them into the system that we're trying to understand. For example, in the top, response to sovereign, Kol Tofit Dodi Dofek very much tries to stress the idea is we should not ever try to understand why anything is happening. Because we don't know. And a partial understanding is unhelpful. In fact, it's futile. Because unless you have a holistic understanding, then how can you explain anything? Our response to suffering, and the Holocaust in particular, must not be to try and ask, why is this happening? But, I don't know why it's happening, but how does God want me to respond? In terms of chesed to others, in terms of, the Rav Soloveitchik talks about the Holocaust and says, the Holocaust teaches us that we did not support the Jews of Europe. Rav Soloveitchik felt very strongly that the American Jewish community was not sufficiently supportive of the Jews in Europe. They could have done more. He says they could have lobbied harder. They were too enamored with SDR, frightened to cause waves. And he says he felt that thousands, hundreds of thousands of people could have been saved if they just been prepared to act. And he said we must not do that again with the Jews of Eretz Israel, of course, in the 1950s, who were in need of support. Compare that with Rav Kook, where he's saying that and when I say Rav Kook, I very much mean Rav Tzvi Yehuda and the Talmidim, because of course Rav Kook himself was died before the Holocaust in the state, which is that we must understand what's happening now. We have to, it's as clear as day. This is obviously Reshit Smichat Geulatenu. This is Geula. The Holocaust is an unspeakable tragedy, but look at the results of the Holocaust. The Holocaust created a disengagement from foreign lands, a training of Jews who were in the rebellions against the Germans, which were suicidal, but created a mindset whereby we could now fight successfully for the land of Israel, a cathartic effect which deepened our nationalism. Rav Soloveitchik is like horrified to try and explain the Holocaust in those terms. Whereas Rav Tzvi Yehuda, he's not saying why God did it, but he's saying, but look, we can understand it. This is what it's resulted in. We could never have had the state without what came before. Clearly, Rav Soloveitchik is not willing to label what we have today as Reshit Smichat Geulatenu, because that's too explicatory. It's not that he doesn't think or doesn't hope that it's a Gula, it's just that he's not prepared to say it. We'll see Norman Lamb, Rabbi Norman Lamb, in a few minutes. Well, clearly, Rav Tzvi Yehuda understands this is absolutely clear. Let's go down to Eretz Yisrael. I put here in Eretz Yisrael, says Rav Soloveitchik, is a land in which Torah and mitzvahs can be fulfilled in the most broad and meaningful way, that it's a means to an end, devoid of inherent metaphysical meaning, whereas Rav Kook, as we saw, says clearly that the land of Israel is a metaphysical reality in and of itself. Religious advantages, Rav, at the bottom of the page, of page 6, Rav Soloveitchik says, look at all amazing things that we can achieve in the state of Israel. A refuge for persecuted Jews, against assimilation, we can fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz, here, to having a state here, to promote Torah study, to apply halacha to social issues. Rav Soloveitchik talks a lot about that. That halacha, as we'll see soon, halacha has been, the dalad amos of halacha have been very limiting in exile. We talk about Shabbos and kashrus, but we don't talk about workers' rights and economics, and the Torah has enormous amounts to say about that. That's the joy of the state of Israel. Whereas Rav Kook understands that the state of Israel is moving us towards the Geula and ultimately Mashiach ben David. Turn over to page 7. The way that they mark the Yom HaTzmaot is very interesting. Rav Soloveitchik, and this is not really because of this issue as much as Rav Soloveitchik is nervous to make halachic innovations in a way that the Rav Kook school is less nervous, but the Rav was very happy to say Tehillim, very passionate about Thanksgiving and Hodah, but not very happy to start messing around with the synagogue service, even with Hallel. Yeah, say Tehillim afterwards. Forget about with a bracha, without a bracha, there's not even halach. Whereas if you go, depending on how extreme you want to go, if you look at I've got an old machzor for Yom HaTzmaot from Kibbutz Adati from the 1950s. Whoa, it's full on. Al Anisim, in Shmona Esrei, Haftorah, you know, and even today, even I feel a little bit, everyone's singing Shema Yisrael, blowing the shofar, singing Anima Amin Be'emunah Shalema Be'viyat HaMashiach. That's the point at which, for me anyway, the Hallel, the Yom HaTzmaot celebrations begin to kind of step over a line that is, well, this is nothing to do with now, this is to do with Mashiach, etc., but find very different approaches. Secular Israelis. What is the role of secular Israelis? Rav Soloveitchik said, it depends. Some of them are good, some of them are okay, some of them are negative. Rav Kook says, they're all Mashiach ben Yosef. They don't even know it yet. It's a rebellion which is for the sake of L'Shem Shemaim that they don't even know, and you can read the Hesped HaGadol that Rav Kook gave in 1904 for Theodor Herzl when he says that secular Zionism is creating Mashiach ben Yosef to bring Mashiach ben David. Wars, this is very important. Wars fought, according to Rav Kook, Rav Soloveitchik, have to be conducted morally, ethically, with a view to maximizing the safety of the people in Israel. Whereas for Rav Kook, it's a milchamet mitzvah. Eretz Yisrael is the Melech. Sorry, it's Medinat Yisrael, is the Melech. And once you start talking in those terms, it's a different kind of war. It has different kind of rules. Rav Soloveitchik, I put at the bottom, he was very keen to stress that the ends do not justify the means. Rav Soloveitchik called for a national inquiry after Sabra and Shatila, where asking whether the Israeli army did enough to prevent the massacre of Sabra and Shatila. And other people in religious Zionism were not happy to go down that route. He said, no, this is called the Milchamed Mitzvah. Stuff happens. I'm not saying everyone said it was okay, but it's a different approach. And you can look yourself and see how you feel about this and whether there's any role for diaspora Jewry. Rav Soloveitchik said absolutely yes. Rav Kook said absolutely no. They should really be coming to Israel and many other things. Go over to page 8. This obviously feeds into whether we're allowed to give any part of Eretz Israel away for a peace treaty. Leaving aside whether we feel it's politically madness or security, but Rav Soloveitchik is very clear that if the military establishment of this country feel that it is necessary to give away parts of Eretz Israel in order to secure a peace in the longer term with our neighbours, that is permitted and even required. Whereas clearly, Rav Tzvi Yehuda said, it's absolute heresy. Because the purpose of the state of Israel as the Melech is to retain the sovereignty of Israel. And to give away the land of Israel is completely self-defeating in that way. Different approaches which come from the same place. Look at what Rav Kook says about the partition plan in 1947. While people were dancing and singing, I don't know if anybody here remembers 1947. You remember? Okay, good. I once gave a ride to a guy. I picked up a guy in the Gush and I took him to Yerushalayim. And he said that we talked about the night in November of the partition plan. He lived in Geula, you know, up in Yerushalayim, or here down the road. He said, which at that time was a mixed neighborhood. He said it was secular and religious Zionist and Haredi as well. Okay, that's changed. But he said that he remembered he had gone to bed, he was a little boy, and his father woke him up and said, you've got to get up and get dressed again. 11 o'clock at night, he said, everybody danced in the street all night till it was time for Shacharis. Said it was unbelievable. Rav Tzvi Yehuda writes, I could not go out and participate in the festivities. Indeed, God's word, they have divided man and is fulfilled. In that condition, my whole body is shaken, wounded all over, cut into pieces. I cannot rejoice. Different perspectives. And you can look at more there as well. But hopefully that's interesting and useful. And again, I will welcome any comments. Let's have a look at Rabbi Lam. In 1975, and I thank my son for bringing this to my attention, there was a kenes in Kibbutz Lavi, which I've been to many times, but wasn't there in 1975. And it was a kenes between Israeli Zionist leaders and American Zionist leaders. Okay, and comparing notes as to what's going on. So have a look at Rabbi Lam's, some of Rabbi Lam's speech there. Obviously, I don't know whether it was given originally in Hebrew or English, but I've got the notes of it in Hebrew. So look at what he says here. Rabbi Lam, of course, one of the major Talmidim and colleagues of Rav Soloveitchik. He says, "Ani lo tzarich la'amin she'tkufateinu hi atchalta b'geula." This is source number 10. I don't have to believe that our period right now is the beginning of Geula, or the Emsa Agula, or the middle of the Geula, or Sof HaGeula, or the end of the Geula. I don't have to believe any of that. B'chdei liyot Yehudi she'medinat Yisrael yikre lo yikara lo mikol chayav. To be a Jew for whom the state of Israel is dearer than life itself. I can be as passionate without having to believe in the whole Geula narrative. Af b'li m'shichiyut. Even without messianism, hello Zohi Amadina she nivata al churban Yadut Europa. Surely this is the nation that we say that we build on the ruins of the Holocaust. Haim ein zo Amadina she tipeinu la meshe kol yemei nedunenu ba'artzot Europa va'arav. Isn't this the state that we daven for? Yes, in many ways it is. Without mashiachiyut, l'shem kach ani lo zakuk lebasis ha'ideologi ha'ra'ayuni shel ha'mashiach. I'm not wedded to a messianic perspective on this. The imze lo Mashiach shegarem l'tkumat ha-medina, and if it doesn't happen to be Mashiach or anything to do with Mashiach, which has made the state of Israel, and ani lo eye karov l'bidinat Yisrael kol yei mechayai, will I be any less connected to Israel? Adarava, on the contrary, he says, kol ha-vikuach al ha-tchata de-geula rak mitzabech. The whole Geula narrative just makes things more murky, confused. Second paragraph. And he loves that she's not atchalat geula. This is a very important point. I'm not saying, he says, this is not atchalat geula. And we'll see Rav Soloveitchik himself in 1948 uses the language atchalat geula about Eretz Yisrael. He says, I'm not saying it's not. And he rak mevakesh ksat tzniut rayonit. I'm just asking for a little bit of intellectual modesty. Ksat yosher intellectuali, some intellectual integrity, honesty. Don't talk about things that really man does not know. How do you know? You don't know. And if you don't know, then don't say. Interesting point. Im yavor Mashiach, if Mashiach indeed comes soon, he says, we'll go and meet him, but after we finished work. Rabbi Yochanan, in Yom Alacha, Ben David, Rabbi Yochanan says, in Ben David's coming, people tell you Mashiach is coming, then finish planting your tree. So and then go and say hey, hello to Mashiach. Don't get carried away with the, and drop everything and run. All of our toil for this country of Israel, all our relationships with this country, they can be just as strong without Geula. And if we get Messianism involved, we're just making things very confused. We'll never be able to get out of that once we get into it. Kol hamit am hazeh, this whole burden, this baggage of Mashiachiyut, lo mosif, it doesn't add anything. Ba'ani choshed, and I'm concerned, she'af Uachgorea, and it may even take away. And he's basing himself on the Rambam, page 9, source number 11. Says the Rambam, after dealing with Hilchas Mashiach in detail, says the Rambam, "Ula'olam lo yitaseik adam bedivrei ha'agadot." Don't get too carried away in agadotas, which we talked about last week, right? Kima, kima, like the sunrise. Says the Rambam, just be careful. "V'lo ya'arich b'midrashot ha'amurim b'inyanim eilu kiyot v'hem." Don't get too obsessed with midrashim that talk about the coming of Mashiach. "V'lo yisinem," it can never make it the center of your religion. We want Mashiach now, or even later. We believe in it. It's an ikah hadat, but it's not the center of Judaism. "She'ein mevin lo yidei yira, v'lo yidei ava." It won't bring you to Yiras Hashem, it won't bring you to Lav Hashem. "V'chein lo yichashev ekitzim." Don't try and work out whether it is the end, when the end is coming. "Amru chacham tichach ruchim shel makashev ekitzim." The people who try and work out when Mashiach is coming are all talking hot air. "Eli yichake," you should wait. "Yamin," you should believe. "V'chlal hadavak kamoshe ve'arim." And the Rambam warns, Mashiach, yes. Messianism, no. And that's where Rav Soloveitchik, is coming from. That's where Rav Lam is coming from. And let me bring you a slightly even more provocative piece from Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, who of course is the Rosh Yeshiva of Shivat HaRetzion, one of the Rosh Yeshiva, himself, the son of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the grandson of Rav Soloveitchik, etc. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein is not scared of every now and then saying something that the religious Zionist world would really rather not hear. He's been doing that always, and he continues. This piece is 22 years old, written in the wake of the Oslo Accords and the Hebron Accords, the Y Accords. Remember all of that from the 1990s? Look at Rav Moshe here. We don't read everything, but he says it how he feels it. "Religious Zionism, number 12, a movement that seeks to bring about Geula, cannot disassociate itself from the general public. Geula is a national event, the historical fulfillment of a nation. The individual can achieve personal redemption. Historical redemption, though, is granted only to a nation. Therefore, the religious Zionist vision requires the alignment of the nation. Estrangement from the people is possible from the B'nai B'rak perspective of individuals and social groups striving to lead their individual Torah life. But it's impossible for Merkaz HaRav Kook's vantage point of Atchasa de Geula. The division within the nation, a reality that can no longer be denied, is what has brought about the current plight of religious Zionism." That's an important first, and this is part of a much bigger essay, which I brought you a link for. First of all, he says, if you're Haredi and live in Bnei Brak, then you can afford to completely disconnect from the Israeli public. Why do you care? It's a different community. You're not trying to... If you're religious Zionist and you believe in a national redemption, then you dare not disassociate from the nation. He's also talking in the wake also of the assassination of Rabin as well, which was done by someone who was seen by the public as representing the religious Zionist world, and that split that was forming back in the 90s. Now, I don't know, with the benefit of hindsight, has that got worse, or has that actually mended somewhat? I actually think it's actually mended a little bit since the 90s, but, you know, everyone has a perspective. A lot of water's flown under the bridge. We've had Gush Katif, we've had a lot of wars down there, and everything that happened there. People, the religious Zionist community, saying if you pull the people out of Gush Katif, you're just going to get rockets. B'kachaya. And therefore, I think that we've seen a lot since then, but Rav Moshe says the following. The strife within the nation and the disparaging rejection of the religious Zionist Geula model by the general public as messianic can either lead to the adoption of a Geula model, meaning we'll force people, in which the nation is unwillingly coerced into participation, or to a recognition that the current situation is a setback to the realization of the dream. The dangers of the first approach are alienation, increased confrontation with the non-religious public, the frustration and bitterness accompanying the unsuccessful attempt to thrust a religious Zionist agenda upon an unwilling public have only paved the way to the verbal and physical violence that have all too frequently occurred in recent years. The more the general public does not respond to the attempt to force Geula upon it, the greater the need to go to greater extremes to do so. And then he says, let's just go to the last paragraph, the shifting focus from the historical achievement to the spiritual situation of the people is a vital spiritual and religious need that is necessary and imperative in and of itself, not only as a means to solving a contemporary crisis. This, though, is an issue of much greater scope than the topic at hand. So state the matter telegraphically. Judaism is interested in the love, awe, and commitment to God much more than in bringing about the Geula. If one must choose between a society that is religiously corrupt, accompanied by Geula, or an average society living a standard Judaism without Geula, there is no doubt that the latter choice is a preferable one. Now, very interesting words. Of course, many in the religious Zionist community have felt that over the last 50 years, since 1967, the religious Zionist community has moved too much onto the hilltops because of this historical Geula focus and out of the towns. Where did the religious Zionist community used to live in the 50s and 60s? It used to live in Bnei Brak. Used to live in Pesach Tikva, still does. Used to live in the towns, in Tel Aviv. Now he lives in Shiloh, and in Hebron, and in the Kiryat Arba, which is wonderful, but all of these people growing up in Tel Aviv do not have the same exposure to the thinking and the teaching of the religious Zionist community as they used to do. And many people feel that that is a major sacrifice that has been made because of the historical focus. And there is now a swing back. There's no question there's a swing back. There are Garinim that are sent to towns, to lodges, to places like that, to try and reseed, if you like, religious Zionism within those towns. Even Har Nof got a Garin of religious Zionist people. I thought that was hilarious. You have to send a Garin of religious Zionism to Har Nof. Amazing. But the point here is that, that Rav Moshe is giving this his grandfather's approach and fleshing it out. What I'd like to just draw your attention to before we finish is, this is for really for your reading. Recently an essay was printed in Tradition in the winter, which was not available to the public until this year. Rav Soloveitchik, in June 1948, weeks after the state, so a few weeks after the state was created, gave a drosha in Yiddish in America to the Mizrahi organization in America. And that drosha was translated just recently into English. And I've brought you a series of extracts from it, which I'm not going to read now. It's based on the idea that is brought in Chazal, that when the Jewish people go into exile, the Shechina goes into exile. I've always been caught by a line in Hoshanah. I connect with this line in number 14. Just look for a second. Source number 14. We say on Sukkot, Kehoshata ma'amar v'hoitseiti etchem. When you saved us and you took the phrase v'hoitseiti etchem, I will take you out. Nakuv v'hoitseiti etchem. That I am taken out with you. That God was in exile. Like in the burning bush. God is in the thorns. And Rav Soloveitchik developed this in a beautiful drosha in 1948, where he says that so much of the Shechina has gone into exile, and Israel is an amazing opportunity to bring Torah in its fullest sense, and religious practice, and awareness of not just of the Dalet Amos of Halacha, of Shabbos and Kashrus and Mikveh, etc., but of all of the social justice perspectives of Judaism, etc. He brings a beautiful line from Bilam. When Balak brings Bilam to curse the people, he only shows them a part of the people. And he says when secular Jews only see a part of Judaism, they despise it because they don't understand it. It looks disconnected and random. They don't see it in holistic terms. If they can see a much bigger vision of what Judaism really is, which is how to run a nation, then that is the redemption issue. It's very beautiful. He talks a lot about the potential idolatry of Eretz Israel, and how to avoid that. But let me just finish in the last minute. Go to the very end to page 12, because I want to bring you this. It's a very beautiful source, and we'll finish with this. Like I said at the beginning, this class of Givat Washington asked their teacher, Miriam Shiloh, in 1968, please write to Rav Soloveitchik and ask him why he didn't make Aliyah, if he's such a big religious Zionist. And she did, and he responded. Number 24. I thank you for your words, and accept your rebuke willingly. Indeed, I sinned against the Holy Land. I am amongst those who have fallen back in not coming to the Holy Land. Of course, many factors that were out of my control prevented me. In spite of this, I am not searching for an excuse, nor am I justifying myself. I am guilty, and the blame rests on my shoulders. Last year, and this is an amazing insight, we, my wife, Zichrona Livracha, and I, decided to come to Israel and remain for about 6 months. To see the land and the people who dwell therein, however many other plans in a man's heart, and what happened, happened, and my sighs are many and my heart is sick. His wife died very young. And clearly he had plans. They had plans together to come to Israel, to try it out, to see, maybe to move. You imagine the rabbi and his wife would have spent another 25 years together living in Eretz Israel. They had by the 70s, just after this, Rav Lichtenstein made Aliyah. I too, he says, a simple Jew would say in the words of the rabbis of Yavna, I teach. And many others who work in the field of Torah education teach. My work is in the large city of New York, in an institution with great numbers of students. And their work is in Givat Washington, or some other moshav, in a similar small institution. One may do much, or one may do little. It is all one, provided he directs his heart to heaven. And he's saying, look, I've not been exactly sitting on my hands for the last 40 years. I've been building American Jewry. in Yeshiva University and all the radiates from it, so I've been very busy. But you see that by the late 60s he was already thinking, I don't know how much this feeling influenced Rav Aaron in his decision to come to Israel. I'm not close enough to the family to know. I could ask Dr. Tova, you know, and sit down with her and speak to her about it. She lives on my street, so, you know, but I'm a bit scared, you know. So, we'll see. I might pluck up the courage. My wife is less scared than I, but I think that was a nice way to kind of just look at that at the end. The Rav Soloveitchik is well aware of it, etc. So, whether I have done any justice at all, we finish here, to Rav Soloveitchik's thinking on religious Zionism, I don't know. But that there is more to read, I do know. And next week, please God, we will come back to Matters Halachic and talk about different issues and move on from there. Thank you so much, and really I would look forward to seeing you all back here and again next week. Please God.